This is Air Talk. I'm Kyle Stokes in for Larry Mantle. Los Angeles Unified Schools Superintendent Austin Buettner has only been the leader of the nation's second largest school district for about 7.5 months now, but already he faces a defining test of his superintendency. The district's teachers union is inching closer to what could be its first strike in 30 years. We get an update on negotiations and speak with Superintendent Austin Buettner right after the news. It's Air Talk on 89.3. From the Moen Broadcast Center, it is Air Talk. I am Kyle Stokes. I'm in for Larry Mantle today. He is on vacation through Friday. It's a pleasure to be with you. Happy New Year to you. Wishing all of you good health and good fortune in 2019. Especially if you are raising kids right now, today is the Air Talk for you. Later today, we will discuss the relentlessness of modern parenting. It's a conversation on not only how much more time intensive it's become to raise a kid, but how expensive it has become and the widening gap between middle and working class parents trying to keep up with the demands of so-called intensive parenting. But right now, we turn to the Los Angeles Unified School District, and the clock is ticking. The district's 30,000 teachers union members have set a deadline of January 10th. If they haven't settled their contract dispute with LAUSD by then, United Teachers Los Angeles will go out on strike. Negotiations have dragged on now for almost 2 years, very little progress, and parents of about 480,000 LAUSD students are now awaiting what happens next. The man across the bargaining table from the teachers union is LAUSD Superintendent Austin Buettner, and Mr. Buettner joins us now. Superintendent, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Kyle. Good morning and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well. So when the union announced their strike date almost 2 weeks ago, union leadership said they were not going to come back to the table unless LAUSD came back with a better offer, or at least what the union felt would be a much better offer. Has the district made one in the intervening days?
So let's first, Kyle, put a little bit of context.
Sure.
We all want the same set of things. We all want to make sure everyone who works in schools is better paid. We all want to work to reduce class size and hire more nurses, counselors, and librarians. The challenge is, how do we do it with the resources we have? So the bargaining process started back in April of 2017. UTLA's set of demands are essentially the same since April of 2017. Los Angeles Unified has continued to revise its offer. Its current offer reflects a report issued by the state fact finder. The state, in an attempt to resolve this or help both sides resolve this, appointed an independent fact finder to come in and take a look and make a series of recommendations. He made his recommendations in the middle of December. We've adjusted our offer to incorporate many of his recommendations. The offer is a 6% raise, back pay to 2017, an additional investment of $30 million to further reduce class size, hire more nurses, counselors, and librarians. Unfortunately, UTLA has not come back to the table. So we asked them on the 17th, when the fact finder issued the report, we asked them a week later, please come back to the table. The fact finder's report can provide a framework to resolve this, and UTLA has refused to engage in any kind of bargaining.
When you came back to them on December 28th, according to a statement I have here, where the district made that second ask for, you know, the resumption of negotiations, did you come back with new offers at that point, or was it just, we want to start talking again?
What we did on the 17th was to let UTLA know we will incorporate much of what the fact finder recommended into our offer.
And much of what the fact finder recommended, we should say, matched up very closely with, I've talked about it as an amalgamation of kind of the September and October offers that LAUSD put together. It looked similar to those offers in terms of some of what the fact finder recommended.
What we've done subsequently is to make crystal clear that even further adjustments that the fact finder recommended, we've incorporated. So, for instance, the 6% has been on the table since September.
The salary increase.
No contingencies, the salaries. Back pay since 2017 has been on the table since that period of time. We've made clear as recently as a week ago that there would be no additional work or professional development required by any UTLA member to earn that. That was an issue of some concern among certain of the members. So we said, fine, we'll take that off the table. So what you'd find, we have on our website, perhaps you can share with your listeners, is a side-by-side comparison of what the fact finder recommended, what the current proposal from LA Unified is, and what UTLA's demands are. It's important to note their demands haven't changed since April of 2017. Ours have changed pretty meaningfully. They conformed what the fact finder recommended. The fact finder has said this is an appropriate set of
right.
To solve this, especially given the financial circumstances that we face.
And we'll walk into some of these issues here and sort of take them point by point. I want to mention at this point that we have reached out to United Teachers Los Angeles. Their president, Alex Caputo-Pearl, is set to join us tomorrow at this time. So we will be hearing from Mr. Caputo-Pearl's side of the argument tomorrow. And I wanted to mention that out front to listeners who might be wondering what the teachers union is thinking about this. But to just sort of dive into some of the issues that are at stake here in this contract negotiation, one that I think both sides mutually agree should be on the table, and there's a lot that in this contract that it doesn't seem like there's even agreement that it should even be discussed. But one thing that is agreed upon is reducing class sizes. The union wants to get rid of this provision in the contract that gives the district a lot of discretion to increase class sizes. I'm wondering, Mr. Buettner, if you'd walk me through the district's position on its class size proposal.
Yeah, what we have said for months, and the fact finder agreed with us, is we should eliminate that provision, and we need to agree on a new provision. Real simple.
Yeah. The problem that the union has...
UTLA has said eliminate the provision, and they will not sit down with us to try to agree on a new provision. The contract has to deal with it in some way, shape, or form. And what we've said for months is the language in the contract, which deals with class size, is over 20 years old. It's a relic. We proposed new language. UTLA has rejected that language. They've not come back with alternate language. The fact finder said it's a relic. The two parties need to come up with new language, and that has been consistently our suggestion to UTLA, which is let's drop the old language and let's come up with a new language. But they have to sit at the table with us to do it. We have more than 30,000 different classes. This is not something where you can say yes or no or eliminate. You actually have to sit and work together to come up with new language, which reflects the reality of the work we do, what happens in each of our classrooms today, and we need them at the table with us doing that.
Part of what they found objectionable when they said they called this offer a Trojan horse, they, you know, sort of out, their response was a lot of what you said, that they did not find the elimination, the language that you wanted to replace it with acceptable. The other thing that they did not like was that it would put into place permanently the class size, you know, baseline. It's not just about giving the district discretion to raise class sizes. They want to lower overall class sizes is what they would say. And they felt that the district's offer would lock into place class sizes they felt would be too big.
Let's separate those two things. So it's one thing for them to say they don't like our proposal, but then they have to work with us. What is their proposal? They don't have a proposal, so they need to come forth with a proposal.
Well, one of the things that they have said is that class sizes could be reduced, for instance, without as much cost as the district says. And I know we're sort of forgive me for throwing a lot of things in the pot.
Let me just finish this.
Sure,
okay?
Sure.
And then we can get into the rebuttal.
Fair enough.
Is, if they don't like our language, please come forward with different language. But to just say you don't like our language when in good faith we've suggested something along the lines of what the fact finder said, they have an obligation to come forward with their proposal to solve it, not just to say we don't like what you said. Now, as far as the intent of all parties to reduce class size, we're in violent agreement. We'd all like to do that. The issue is we have financial limitations, and we've heard from two independent task forces, one put together by Superintendent Cortinas in 2015, one by Superintendent King in 2018. We've heard from the California Superintendent of Public Instruction, the Los Angeles County Office of Education. Those two governmental bodies are our regulator who oversee us. And now, most recently, the state-appointed independent fact finder. All of those have said there are budget issues and LA Unified does not have the money to meet all of UTLA's demands.
Right.
Said that clearly. So the challenge is, what do we do with the resources we have today, and how do we work together at the state level to get more resources.
I want to talk about
funding in our schools comes from the state. So the notion that we could unilaterally increase our funding, that's just not how it works. The notion that we could meet all of their demands when all of these experts have said we can't. We have to deal with the reality of the budget issue we have today. And the value conversation about what we'd like to do, we're in agreement.
Yeah. Let me put a pin in that conversation about the state of the district's finances, because that's worthy of discussion. But I want to make sure we can address some of these issues head on. On the class size piece, which is a very popular driving issue among the rank and file in UTLA, the union says that it might not be as costly. Part of their fact-finding contribution to the fact-finding report was that they felt that it would not cost as much as the district says it was. In fact, a lot of it could be cost neutral because there are already so many employees in the school district that are licensed, credentialed teachers, but not in teaching roles. What would that not be something that would help? Looks like we've lost Superintendent Buettner for a moment. His cell phone connection has cut out. We should mention that we are going to have the president of United Teachers Los Angeles, Alex Caputo-Pearl, on the air with us tomorrow for a conversation about some of these same contract issues. The news today is that the LAUSD has put out a statement recently saying that they went back to UTLA over the week of Christmas on December 28th. They asked UTLA leaders to resume contract negotiations and resolve the remaining issues at stake here. And the superintendent, Austin Buettner, what we just heard him say was that United Teachers Los Angeles was not interested in speaking at that time. Austin Buettner saying that there was not necessarily what he was saying was that the LAUSD changed its offer to essentially line up with a lot of what the fact finder recommended. The fact finder is a neutral third party that has been looking at the issues at stake here in this conversation, and the job of the fact finder was to weigh in on which side's contract offer made more sense. And so LAUSD has what Buettner is saying is that the LAUSD has changed its offer to line up with the fact-finding report. And that is the so-called new offer, what the district would term a new updated offer that is on the table to UTLA. I'm sure UTLA might respond to that by saying that that doesn't represent the kind of movement that they have been looking at. We've just gotten Buettner back on the line. Mr. Buettner, sounds like your cell phone might have cut out there, or your phone connection there.
You were just asking a question. Go ahead.
Yeah, definitely. So we were talking about class sizes. And the question was that there are about 2,000 licensed credentialed teachers, the union says, that are in non-teaching roles. They aren't in classrooms. You just move those teachers into classrooms and bingo, you've solved a huge chunk of the class size problem without a lot of cost. What's wrong with that idea?
We'd be delighted to. So the bulk of those are UTLA members, however, who are counselors and restorative justice counselors, and they fill other roles. So moving them all will have consequence. Moving some, we think, is a good idea. But again, we have to sit at the table and do this. What has been absent from this conversation, Kyle, is any concrete proposal from UTLA to do this. Put it in writing. Tell us what you'd like to do. Their last, best, and final is still the same offer of April 2017. So even this notion of moving some of the licensed, credentialed counselors back into the classroom, put it in writing. We'd be happy to sit at the table tomorrow, tonight, and work it through and see if that can help us get there. But we have to step away from the rhetoric and start dealing with facts. So if they have a concrete proposal on how to address class size, like the one you're suggesting or the one they're suggesting, let's sit down, let's get back to the bargaining table and try to resolve this.
We're speaking with LAUSD Superintendent Austin Buettner about the ongoing contract negotiations with United Teachers Los Angeles, UTLA, setting a January 10th deadline to potentially go on strike if they have not resolved a contract dispute with the district by that time. Coming up later in the hour, we're going to open the phones to you, parents. We want to know whether you are going to support a strike, what your thoughts are on this potential essential for a teacher's strike? And if so, for how long would you be willing to support teachers walking off the job for a work stoppage? Teachers, curious to hear your thoughts as well. How long are you hoping that a possible strike would last? We're not going to take direct questions for Superintendent Buettner, but we will take your thoughts later on in the hour. The phone number that we'd like to hear your thoughts at is 866-893-5722. Again, that's 866-893-KPCC or on the AirTalk page at kpcc.org. Back with Superintendent Austin Buettner after a quick break. This is AirTalk on KPCC. Back with you on Air Talk here on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Kyle Stokes in for Larry Mantle, and I'm speaking with LAUSD Superintendent Austin Buettner on the as the deadline ticks closer, the union set deadline of January 10th to resolve a contract dispute. The union says they will go on strike if there is no contract agreement by then. Superintendent, another issue on the table here being salaries, and you mentioned recently that the district has put a lot of money into its proposed salary increase, recently removed a lot of strings attached to that salary increase. But the union's asks have spanned a wider range of issues than salaries. They're looking for a lot more staffing for nurses, teachers, class sizes. Most of the money that the district has put on the table has gone into salary. I'm curious why the district strategy hasn't been to address a wider range of the teachers' issues, put more money into class sizes and potentially less into salary.
We'd be delighted. So I'll take you back to something, and I'm going to be repeating myself, Kyle. Their proposal, their offer, is the same one since April 2017. Same one. Take it all or take it none. Take none of it is what they've told us. If they wish us to shift some portion from salary into class size, into hiring more nurses, counselors, and librarians, we'd be willing to entertain that, but they need to come forth with a proposal to us. Absent that, what we've done is to try to respond to what we believe are the most important set of issues for UTLA membership. But if UTLA leadership, on behalf of their members, tell us they'd be prepared to take a lesser increase and invest those dollars instead in class size or instead in additional nurses, counselors, and librarians, we'd be happy to entertain that. But again, they have to come forward with something concrete that we can react to.
Well, is that your feeling, that really what they're holding out over here is salary? Is that what your opinion is what this all comes down to?
It's not my opinion, Kyle. It's what they have given us in their proposal. And if you look at their proposal also includes back pay for a prior contract to 2016. Okay? So does back pay to 2016 begin to address the issue of class size? Do those resources used for back pay help us hire additional people to help in schools? So they have to come forth and tell us which amongst all of their demands are more important to them and their members, which they believe will help us do better in school.
I mean, just to be clear, is
which of these investments is actually going to help drive change and help our students make progress? And what we'd like to do is engage in that conversation. But when they give it all or nothing, and all of the different experts have told us that we cannot afford the all, then we need to engage in a conversation which is, how do we do the best with what we have, and we're still waiting for UTLA to tell us which aspect of all of their demands are more important and which are less important.
I think what the union might respond to that is that there are a bunch of issues on which the district's offer has just been, no, we're not going to entertain any kind of change to, for instance, magnet schools. The teachers' union wants a say in the conversion of a school over to a school of choice. The district's response, your response has been no, when there are a lot of underlying issues that could be bargained into the contract, even if what they're asking for at the outset is not a starter for you.
Well, so let's talk about magnet schools. That's a good one. Enrollments increased a lot, more than a third, 30-some-odd percent. Achievement is fantastic. Parents like it. Students like it. And most recently, the state of California, PERB, Public Employer Review Board, has told us that that's not even lawfully a subject of bargaining. Shouldn't be on the table in the first place. So what would you like us to do about that one? We think it's a good thing. We'd like to keep growing our magnet program because it's clearly working. The state has told us that UTLA shouldn't be coming to the table and putting that on the bargaining table in the first place. So I don't think that's one we should spend a lot of time on unless the state gives us different direction. I'd prefer to focus on the issues of class size, which is important, the issue of how we get more resources in schools, how we balance that against the needs to pay people as well as we can. And let's connect the value conversation to the money conversation, because we're pretty far into this conversation, Kyle, without talking about what the experts have told us. We have serious budget issues. So just to have a value conversation about what we like to do without recognizing that we have real constraints on what we can afford to do, I think it's a bit of a sophistry. Right. We'd be careful about going too far down that path without talking about our very real budget constraints.
And I promise that we will discuss the district's finances, but I have to ask one more question on the issues. You say that the issue of salary, your opinion is that the district, that the union's salary proposal, that their salary demand makes it clear that they are holding out for more back pay and a slightly larger raise. I guess my response is that, you know, you've put a lot of money on the table for salary already. You've nearly matched their demand. And I guess I don't understand why it would be that salary is still the sticking point here when you basically match their offer and they're still holding out. Doesn't that mean that they're looking for something deeper, more meaningful engagement from you on other issues?
Well, then they should tell us that. How about we sit at the table and have that conversation?
All right. So let's move to those district finances. The foundation of this dispute, as you've said, is really over how much money LAUSD has to spend on this contract, this talking point of there being a $2 billion reserve in LAUSD. The union likes to point out that this reserve exists. Talk me through the argument about what that $2 billion reserve is. They say that the district is sitting on top of that money and refusing to spend it.
So let's go through that, okay? Almost $200 million of it is already spent for raises for our bus drivers, for our cafeteria workers, for our clerical staff, for the engineers who keep the air conditioner running in our schools. About $300 million is set aside to pay for the 6% increase for UTLA members, okay? Another $300 million is committed by law to certain students in certain schools. This was referred to as target student populations under local control funding formula. That money can only be used to supplement the programs for those students, not to supplant. So that money is legally committed. About $250 million has already been sent to schools to be used by the discretion of school principals. And I think if you understand how a school operates, the year-to-year fluctuations, they may have be saving that dollar to hire a math tutor come next calendar year, but they don't hire that individual in March. They hire the individual in July. And about $100 million is set aside for legal settlements and others, which leaves us, as of June of this year, about $700 million to pay for future deficits.
Right. So essentially,
$500 million a year on operations, meaning we're spending about $500 million more a year than what we take in. And all of the experts have told us, in the next couple of years, there's a reckoning because the reserves run out. We can only spend them once, can't spend them twice or three times. And then when we run out, we have to do something very different. So we are spending the reserves. The notion that we're sitting on them is not true. From an accounting standpoint, you wind up with some funny accounting because the reserves to pay for UTLA members continue to grow. It's a check that hasn't been cashed. But we are putting aside the money to pay for the 6% increase. So the reserve, from an accounting standpoint, continues to grow. But it's actually been committed to be spent because if we're told UTLA members are going to get a 6% increase, we better make sure we set aside the money to pay for it.
Right. I mean, the budget does outline the plans to spend this money, and it, which does undercut to an extent the UTLA's claim that the district is simply just hoarding the money. On the other hand, the point here that I think the union would make is, doesn't the fact that this reserve exists at all undercut the claim that the district is spending at unsustainable levels? If it has been true that we've been spending hand over fist more beyond the district's means for years, doesn't the fact that we now have a huge reserve, $2 billion, that's a lot of money, undercut the very claim that we're spending unsustainably?
Well, first, put $2 billion in context. We'll spend over the next 3 years $24 billion So $2 billion sounds a lot until you realize we're spending $24 billion. I wasn't part of the district, how the reserve built up. A whole variety of factors came into play. The experts have said we're spending it. We've said to UTLA, if you don't agree with that, bring in your auditors and talk to our auditors and come up with a different set of figures if they can. UTLA has not been willing to do that. So we have what our auditors have told us is being spent, where the money is going. We've had five outside experts from the state, the county, and independent commissions tell us the money is being spent and will soon run out. Those are the facts. And what we have to do is ground all this conversation in the facts. And it's somewhat disappointing to me that almost 2 years in, we can't agree on the basic facts.
Right.
We either have the money or we don't. We're either spending it or we're not. That's a matter of fact. And the experts have told us we are spending it and that we can't spend it twice or three times. We can only spend it once. So what we should be talking about is how do we plan for a future so that we don't spend ourselves into insolvency and a state takeover, but rather we spend prudently now, that we work together to increase resources and increase funding for our schools so we can together achieve what we all want.
A discussion that would need to take place in Sacramento. LAUSD Superintendent Austin Buettner speaking with him. Want to take your calls later in the hour. Coming up in just about 10 minutes or so, we'll begin taking calls. So the phone lines are open, hoping to hear from teachers and parents in the LA Unified School District about the possibility of an ongoing strike. I just want to give the phone number here, Superintendent, so folks know to call in 866-893-5722. Again, the number 866-893-5722, standing by to take your calls. Superintendent Austin Buettner, I want to return to you quickly and pick up on a point that you were mentioning. There has been renewed talk of insolvency, as you mentioned. The district potentially getting to a very close to a brink financially has been the argument you have made, and that an LA County official said, coming to the school board saying we might have to intervene, maybe even appoint a fiscal advisor with the power to veto school board decisions in order to get LAUSD's fiscal house in order, which would be calamitous for LAUSD, but I think it's also fair to say some fiscal hawks sound pretty desperate to rein in spending in the district. So I want to play you some tape from LA Unified School Board member Nick Melvoin, and this is something that he told me about this possibility of takeover in September.
Without changes to our budget, in 9 years, half of our budget, 50% of our budget, will be going to healthcare and pensions. If the only way to fix that, because we have an unreasonable teachers union who is not putting the interests of kids, families, and teachers first, is to go into state receivership and force a restructuring, then that has to be on the table. Because this isn't, we're not playing around.
Superintendent, do you agree with school board member Nick Melvoin on that point?
Well, let's go back to a bigger frame here, which is the experts have told us we're spending more than we're taking in. That's clear. The experts have told us. Okay, not my opinion, not your opinion, not UTL leadership's position. The experts have told us that. The experts have told us that we need to be working together to solve this and that we're going to have to figure out a way to convince the public we need more resources. That's commonly shared. That's not subject to interpretation. The question is, how do we do that work? Because so much of this conversation, Kyle, has been about a contract, a 350-page piece of paper between one set of leadership and a different set of leadership. When folks who do the work in schools, they don't carry the contract with them to school. They go to work, serve the interests of their students as best they can. We need to make sure they're taken care of. They have the resources to do their job. That's the conversation we need to be engaging in, and it's going to take change. The experts have told us we have to change. Missing from this conversation is how do we go about that change in a collaborative way? Public education is the ultimate labor management collaborative. You'll note I said labor first because it is people who do the work. We spend all of our budget on people. So we should be at the table talking with our labor partners on how we can do things differently, how are we going to better serve the needs of our students, and how do we go forward from here. So much on the contract, I think, actually distracts us from the great challenge ahead, which is how are we going to make it work for our students.
Do you believe that receivership needs to be on the table? As a backstop to a teachers union, if they're not willing to come to the table and have that conversation, do you believe that receivership needs to be on the table?
Well, receivership's not a choice we make. It's a choice the state or the county may make for us. My job is to do everything I can to work with our labor partners to avoid that, because that's how we protect and serve our students. We want to keep schools open. We want our students safe and learning in schools. We want to do the best possible job we had. And it's our responsibility. It's mine, the superintendent. It's the board's. It's UCLA leadership's to say that's our job. That's our goal. Has to be to do the best we can for students. And if we get to the point where the state decides to take over the school district, it's because collectively leadership, all of us, utility leadership, the board and myself, haven't done our jobs to try to avoid that.
In just about 30 or 40 seconds, Superintendent, one final question to you. The district's state funding is calculated on a daily basis, obviously meaning, you know, that means absences, as you well know, cost the school district money. There are a lot of parents who want to stand by teachers saying they won't cross the picket lines if they end up going on strike. What would you say to those parents if that's what happens and a strike becomes a reality?
My responsibility, our responsibility, is to provide the best possible education we can. Schools are going to be open. They're going to be safe and welcoming, and students will continue to learn. That's the way we support our students, and that's my job. There are 700,000 students each and every day who come to school in Los Angeles Unified. We're going to make sure they're safe, welcome, and getting the best possible education they can.
LAUSD Superintendent Austin Buettner joining us this morning on Air Talk. Thank you so much, Superintendent.
Thank you, Kyle.
He's joining us on the eve of a deadline by the teachers union, not necessarily the eve. There's still a few days here before a January 10th deadline at which the union has said they would go out on a possible strike. Tomorrow at this time here on Air Talk, we'll hear from Alex Caputo-Pearl, the president of United Teachers Los Angeles. We'll be asking him about a lot of the same issues. We want to hear from parents and teachers in LAUSD. Do you support a strike? And if so, for how long? Give us a call, 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-5722, or comment on the AirTalk page if you would like. That's all coming up after a break. Your phone calls in just a moment. But first, we will come back after a news break with Hedy Lynn Hurdies. You're listening to Air Talk here on 89.3 KPCC. We're discussing the potential for a possible strike by the teachers in the Los Angeles Unified School District. We just heard from the superintendent, Austin Buettner, and his thoughts trying to prevent a teacher's strike. The teachers' union's president, Alex Caputo-Pearl, is going to join us tomorrow on Air Talk at this exact same time, 10 a.m. We'll be discussing a lot of the same issues. I want to make sure you join us for that conversation. Right now, though, I want to hear from you. I want to hear especially from parents and teachers in the Los Angeles Unified School District. Your thoughts on the possibility of a teacher work stoppage. Parents, do you support the idea of teachers going out on strike? LAUSD teachers, if you can join me and tell me, for how long are you thinking it's possible that you will be out on this work stoppage, out on the picket lines? Would you support as well a strike by the union United Teachers Los Angeles? Going to get to your calls right away here, but I'll give out the number first for those who want to join us. It's 866-893-KPCC. Again, that's 866-893-5722, or go online to the AirTalk page at kpcc.org. Rachel in Highland Park joins us. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. So my daughter is in sixth grade. There's 37 kids in her class. She loves her teacher. We love her teacher. He's relatively new. He's full of great new ideas, but there's a lot of kids in our class with very high energy. And so we would really support a meaningful discussion about how class size can be accurately measured by the district. The numbers that I've seen put out don't seem to really accurately reflect what I know is the case with the schools in our neighborhood and across the district. So she knows she has to work. She's planning with her friends lesson plans. They each have they divided it up by subject matter, and they're getting ready in case they need to be. So they will be working while they're out of school.
Rachel, do you buy what the district is saying? Their point is, we'd like to reduce class sizes by a lot more, but that there isn't the money available to do so. Do you sympathize with that argument?
I put that on squarely in front of our board members, not our superintendent and not the teachers' union. If what they're saying is true, then I would have expected to see a revenue creation plan for years now. And instead, they chose, instead of somebody with sort of experience specifically in negotiations who handled the last negotiations with the teachers' union and who came up through the system with experience in education, they chose somebody from the outside because presumably he was going to have creative ideas from business. And I thought that would have had, ideas about increasing revenue by going to the voters in 2018. Instead, we saw a slowdown on that process. So if what they're saying is true, I haven't seen it backed up with plans for action. And so I think there's a credibility gap.
Right. Rachel, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your time.
Thanks.
I want to go to Kenya in Mid-Wilshire. Kenya, you're a parent of LAUSD. You say you're not supportive at this moment of a strike.
I am not supportive as a parent of two children in special, one child in special education and one child who is upward bound and pretty much university bound, or an IC that teachers are not grading or not providing adequate and quality education, not even grading the schoolwork in December where they're not even on strike. And I have to put my kids in private tutoring to basically make sure they are filling in the gap for their education, making sure they're receiving the proper education because the teachers are either not attending their classrooms or not doing the proper following special education code. I mean, I could go on and on. I'm very involved. I understand they want their appropriation, their money, and their allocation of their budget. However, as the superintendent stated, you can't allocate certain funding if it's already allocated by law to certain appropriations.
Right.
So I'm not supportive because I used to receive emails from teachers that are going on strike during school time. And so to me, you should focus on the children. Children education is public. It is a public service at the end of the day.
Kenya, can I ask you what your plans are for childcare? If the strike were to happen, what your plans are?
I mean, I'm fortunate enough to be in business, so I can support my kids and have the flexibility to take them to private tutoring and to spend time with them. What happens to the other families, especially the underserved families that don't have that ability? So it'll basically put up my schedule, my business schedule. I will have to accommodate and just work part-time, but at the end of the day, they're my kids. So that's how I'm going to work with that and have my family involved to support me. But when it comes to other families that are not fortunate enough with those resources and those accommodations, how do you answer those questions?
Right. Kenya, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate your time. I want to go to Danielle in Silver Lake. Danielle, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So you said that initially you were opposed to the strike, but the conversation, how did you respond to what Mr. Buettner had to say?
Well, I was disappointed that he never mentioned the fact finder's desire to see them pursue revenue. The fact finder bemoaned the no parcel tax, the effort to work together to get revenue from Sacramento from the new governor. All he felt was hold the line, and that we're going to have a crisis and all of that, rather than being positive and pursuing the money that the fact finder said in the report.
Danielle, thank you so much for your time. We've got to get to break here on 89.3 KPCC. We're going to be coming back with more of your calls here to discuss the LAUSD teachers' strike, the potential for a teachers' strike, we should say. The union setting a deadline of January 10th. If there is no deal in place by then, the teachers have said they will walk off the job. Want to let you know that we are still taking calls from parents and teachers in LAUSD. We want to hear your thoughts on the possibility of a strike. 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page. We'll be back in 1 minute here on KPCC. We're taking your calls here on Air Talk from parents and teachers in the Los Angeles Unified School District about the possibility of a teachers' strike in the nation's second largest school district. I want to go to Emily in Mid-City. Emily, you're a chair of your local chapter of United Teachers Los Angeles.
That is correct. Good morning.
Good morning. So you support a strike?
I absolutely support a strike.
Why do you do so?
Well, we have a nurse only on Thursdays. So are our students expected to only be ill and injured on Thursdays? We have students who have issues that they're suffering from trauma and need psychological services, and we only have a psychologist on staff one day a week. In order for these students to learn, we need the support staff at school every day. And so this is what we are fighting for. This is what teachers, UTLA, and community are fighting for. We want schools that our students deserve.
Emily, when the district says that they don't have the money to pay for things like the staffing increases, not only for you know, nurses, which you mentioned, librarians is part of the union's contract demands, more counselors, deans, psychiatric social workers. The district says, great, we don't have the money to pay for it. How do you hear that?
I find that very hard to believe with nearly a $2 billion reserve fund. And Buettner does not seem to be willing to talk about raising additional revenue. And that's what we need him to come to the table to talk to us about.
You know, right.
we want to continue the public education for all students. And so that's what we're waiting for.
Yeah. Emily mentioning revenue. Thank you so much for joining us, Emily. Emily mentioning revenue, and it should be noted as well, several callers have mentioned the need to go out and look for more revenue. The school board considered briefly the option of putting a parcel tax, which is a sort of property tax, on the ballot back in a couple of months ago now. I forget the exact date. And the board voted against it, narrowly against it, saying that the rationale given, at least by Superintendent Buettner at the time, was that there was no campaign in place in order to go out and get such a parcel tax passed. But obviously, as hearing from these callers, the issue of revenue is still definitely out on the table and part of the conversation here. I want to go to Sikivu in South LA. Sikivu, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
How do you feel about a possible strike?
I'm totally 100% behind UTLA. I have a daughter that's at 74th Street Elementary School. I also do youth leadership work in high schools in South LA. And I think that this is a really critical turning point for educational justice in Los Angeles. It's absolutely egregious that we have a superintendent who is claiming that there are no resources for counselors, for nurses, for librarians, for after-school programs, for restorative justice. You have millions of dollars literally that are going to support a bloated police state regime where you have school police that are regularly deployed on South LA campuses to the exclusion of college preparation, programming, initiatives, and counselors. So I think it's absolutely egregious and shameful that we're at this juncture. And again, we're 100% in support of UTLA. And I will be keeping my daughter out of school. We will not be crossing picket lines.
How do you think, among the people that you know, how do you think that, what's the breakdown of people who are going to potentially cross the picket lines? What would be the pie chart of people who are going to do it, send their children to school, perhaps because they have no other option, and parents who are going to keep their kids home? What do you think it's going to turn out to be?
Well, I think in my community that there will be some ambivalence precisely because of what you just cited, the resources, the fact that we have parents that are working one, two, and three jobs that may not be able to provide for child care. So we're going to have to pool our resources in our local communities here. We're going to have to develop some type of collective system to tide us through this turbulent time. But again, ideologically, I think that many parents viewing the conditions from the ground, particularly in Black and Latinx communities, where we are being over-policed and seeing our young people pushed out as early as elementary school, being suspended and expelled and over-disciplined in disproportionate numbers, that reflects very directly on the bloated regime of policing that the LAUSD has employed for the past decade.
Sakivu in South LA. Thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your time. Phyllis tweets to AirTalk, I'm an LAUSD teacher, and I will stay out as long as it takes to get what our students need. Lisa in Glendale writes, I'm an LAUSD teacher of special education at an elementary school, and I support the impending strike because I'm looking out for my students. We have too large of a class sizes. We need nurses in our schools. I want to go to Kate in downtown Los Angeles. Kate, you're a student.
Hi, I am not a parent, nor am I a teacher. I am a student, and I support teachers and UTLA members 100%. Are downtown LA.
Kate, we lost you for just a second there. I appreciate your time. I'm going to have to let you go. I just don't want to risk losing your connection when we have some other calls here. Let's go to Lance in Playa del Rey. Hi, Lance. How are you?
Yeah, hello.
Thank you so much for joining us. What's your comment?
Yeah, hi. Yeah, I'm a teacher in South Los Angeles. And while I do support the strike, I just wanted to, you know, impress upon people that certainly the teachers that I know don't take this lightly. And we certainly have never, the teachers that I know, we certainly never lost view of our responsibilities to the students. And there was a caller earlier who talked about her experience with teachers, you know, kind of dropping the ball in December. And that certainly was not my experience, nor that of my colleagues. And I'd like to, you know, point out, for example, that, you know, I'm still writing letters of recommendation all break through the break. As are other colleagues of mine.
Lance, how do you view as a teacher the sort of trade-off between striking to potentially impress upon the district what the union's demands are, but also the you know, disruption that that's going to bring into the lives of your students? How do you weigh that balance?
You know, again, it's really, really difficult. The problem is I just don't see that there's another way to sufficiently establish the importance of this. It seems like short of this kind of disruption, which is significant, it doesn't seem that we get that we can focus the attention of administrators on some of our needs in the classroom. And those needs are significant. I'm one of the teachers who does believe that this is not just about salaries.
Right. Lance in Playa del Rey, thank you so much for joining us, a teacher in South L.A. Appreciate those of you who have joined us today. Patty in East L.A. called in to say that she is a teacher and a parent, and as a teacher, that's bigger as an issue right now for me. We're the second largest school district in the country, and it is time for us to stand up and fight back. Danae in West Hills called in to say, we have two kids in LAUSD. We'll stay out as long as the teachers are out. I think Mr. Buettner is not being truthful when he says school will continue as it is. Those comments coming. Thank you to all of the parents and teachers who called in to weigh in on the heels of our interview this morning with LAUSD Superintendent Austin Buettner, calling us with this January 10th deadline looming, at which point the teachers union has said they will walk out on strike if there is no contract agreement in place by then. We're going to speak tomorrow with United Teachers Los Angeles President Alex Caputo-Pearl about many of the same issues that we posed to Superintendent Austin Buettner. To the parents whose ears I've now grabbed, stay with us here at this point. We're going to talk after this break about modern parenting and how relentless it has become. Stick with us.
Southern California, the home of Hollywood, Dodgers, Disneyland. Sometimes it feels like paradise. But any second now, that could change. Because a big earthquake is coming.
This will happen. There's no likelihood of it not happening. We are not stopping plate tectonics.
When the earthquake hits, our world will be shaken. So what can you do to prepare? I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
From the Moen Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. I'm Kyle Stokes, in for Larry Mantle, who is on vacation through Friday. Happy New Year to you. Thanks again for joining us. Coming up, the longest known road trip in the solar system. How long? No big deal. Just a few billion miles. We'll discuss the visit to Ultima Thule coming up later on this hour of Air Talk. But first, parents, do you feel exhausted? I mean, be honest now. You are always on. You're spending more of your free time with your kids. You might be spending more money on your kids than you would have in the 1990s on, you know, lessons, sports teams, activities, coaching, tutoring. And if you're not spending it, chances are you feel like you should be spending it. That is what the New York Times recently called the relentlessness of modern parenting, the title of a piece outlining how the whole enterprise of raising kids is becoming not only more demanding, but more expensive. With me to discuss the piece is the author, a correspondent for the New York Times, Claire Kane Miller. She wrote the piece for The Upshot, a Times site for the analysis of policy and economics. Claire Kane Miller writes about the intersection of gender, families, and the future of work. Claire Kane Miller, thank you so much for joining us.
It's great to be here.
Yeah, I just want to know why you decided to write this piece.
So I had read this fact a few years ago, and it just continued to stick with me. And it comes from American Time Use Diaries. And it was that working mothers today spend as much time doing hands-on childcare as stay-at-home mothers in the 70s. And this has just continued to stun me, but also makes a lot of sense as, you know, I parent and I see friends parenting. And then at the same time, I kept reading these new studies trying to explain why women's labor force participation, the share of women who are working outside the home, plateaued in the 90s. And one of the reasons is that parenting has become harder. It's become more time intensive. It's become more expensive. Parents are expected to do more. And all of this together made me wonder what was going on. So I started looking into it.
Right. So to sort of sum it up, it's sort of like there's a two-step process here. First, it's parenting got harder, and now there's this sort of question, why are we seeing these statistics among working class parents? How can parents handle this burden, especially given the sort of intersection of all the other pressures that they face in their life when parenting is becoming one of the bigger pressures? Does that about sum it up?
Yeah, that's right. And this has been something that upper middle class parents, mostly white parents, have been doing since the mid-90s. It's not a surprise to anyone. But what's new is that this has become what people across class and race lines in America, what, you know, most people now say is the right way to parent, is to basically spend as much time as possible with your kid, be monitoring them constantly, be teaching them constantly, and that most people, whether or not you can afford it, whether or not you have time to do it, most people now agree that this is the best way to do it.
Right. Claire Kane Miller, stay with us here. I want to bring in someone who was among the first academics to chronicle and document this phenomenon, the rise of what is being called in, this is an academic term apparently, intensive parenting. Annette Leroux is a professor of sociology at the University of Pennsylvania. She studies social class differences in family life there. Annette, thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You were among the first people to coin the term or document what is intensive parenting. What is it?
Well, and all parents want their children to be healthy and happy. But traditionally, upper middle class parents, parents who have a college degree, who work in a professional job, they seek relentlessly to develop their children's talents and skills. So even leisure activities such as packing for a vacation in Hawaii becomes an opportunity to practice verbal skills and fractions. And so parents enroll their kids in organized activities, and they also answer questions with questions. They use reasoning. They also intervene in schooling. And using a gardening analogy, I called that concerted cultivation, which is very similar to intensive parenting. It's exhausting.
Yeah. So the you're saying that there are parents out there who would take a mundane activity like packing a piece of luggage and say, now, how does this, what percentage of this suitcase is full? I mean, they turn everything into a learning opportunity?
They certainly feel the obligation to do that. But, yes, coming back from church, they read an article in Time magazine, and they say, oh, here's something about dinosaurs. An African-American middle-class family who we were following, I had research assistants, and we followed them through their homes every day for about a month. And they were coming back from church, and the boy was saying he liked a particular X-Men. And his dad was demanding to know why. And essentially he wanted to have a thesis like you would have in a college, and he wanted and have evidence to support the claim.
So, and Annette Leroux, I'm curious, we've all heard the term helicopter parenting, and it sort of has this negative connotation. Now, that term is so baked into our national societal psyche, but I get the sense that it's a different term and refers to something different. Can you help draw the distinction for us, and how is intensive parenting or concerted cultivation different?
Well, I mean, reasonable people disagree, but helicopter parenting are parents who have trouble letting go and who have trouble letting their children have experiences on their own to grant their children autonomy. And people can engage in concerted cultivation or intensive parenting and still let their child move away to college, not only call them once a week or every couple weeks. Helicopter parenting, parents can't tolerate that. They have to know all the time what their children are doing.
Professor, you wrote in 2012, we live in a society where institutional standards are heavily influenced by the middle class's child-rearing practices. Obviously, not all parents are middle class. How does class intersect with this phenomenon? How does a working-class parent experience a phenomenon that's defined by middle-class tastes?
Well, all parents want their kids to be healthy and happy, but working-class families that I studied, they saw adulthood as looming with many difficulties. So they saw their childhood as a chance to protect their children. So their children played outside, they watched TV, they hung out with their cousins. They tended not to have organized activities, and if they had them, they had a different purpose, which was just to keep them busy. Well, the upper middle class parents saw their kids that they could grow up and do anything. And so they saw they didn't want him to be Mozart, but they wanted him to learn piano. So parents were always cultivating and developing their kids, and they felt it was their duty to do so.
Right. Thank you so much. Stand by with us, Annette Leroux, professor of sociology at the University of Pennsylvania. I'm interested to hear from you as an AirTalk listener. We want to understand what it means for parents of different socioeconomic backgrounds, of different racial backgrounds, of different cultural backgrounds, to try and keep up with these societal expectations of parenting. I'm curious to know, are you spending more on your children, whether it's their education or on their extracurricular activities? Are you able to keep up with the pace of modern parenting? And have you been able to make it all stop? Give me a call. I'd like to hear your thoughts on this at 866-893-KPCC. Again, that phone number, 866-893-5722. Go online to our AirTalk page as well to leave a comment. I want to bring in Matthias Depka, who is a professor of economics at Northwestern University. Matthias, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Matthias joining us via Skype. Now, one of the pieces in this, we're talking about the intersection of class. One of the interesting findings of this piece is that we're discussing today, called the Relentlessness of Modern Parenting in the New York Times, is just how much parents are spending out of their pocketbooks on their own children. I'm wondering what we know about how much parents are spending, financially, and how much time parents are spending today on child rearing, and how that might have changed over time.
So we know quite a bit on the time use side. We have these time use surveys that were already mentioned, and those clearly show that the time parents spend on parenting has gone up enormously over time. And together with this idea of concerted cultivation, it has gone up particularly for elements of child rearing that have this element of stimulation. So, for example, reading to children, playing with children, helping children with homework, all these things have gone up by a large multiple from the 1970s to the present.
Interesting.
At the same time, we also have data. Yes?
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. And we also see that extracurricular activities like music lessons, sports activities, also just expenses for private schools have gone up enormously. And, of course, for the expense side, this is where the social differences play an important role, because if you have a family that doesn't have the same income, doesn't have the same resources as maybe an upper middle class family, for them it would be just harder to keep up with those same expenses.
Claire Kane Miller, I'm wondering if you can talk us through the statistics here. How much is it that middle class, there's a chart in your piece that outlines just how much the gap has grown between the working class and the upper middle class or the super rich.
That's right. So the richest parents are just spending a huge amount more. Everyone is spending more. Poor parents are spending a larger share of their income than they used to. But of course, their income is smaller. So the amount they're spending is not that much higher, even if it's a larger share. The middle 50% of incomes are spending more, but it's really, really the richest parents who are pulling ahead for obvious reasons. They have the money to spend, so they can do the tutors and the special therapists and the lessons and, the fancy colleges and the private schools and all the nannies and all these things that really cost a lot of money. And one of the things that the social scientists, including Professor Debke and others, have found is that this is really rooted in the rise in inequality. There is no longer a guarantee in this country that your children are going to do better than you are. There is such a race to get into college and to get into the middle class, and such a fear that your children won't, of people at all income levels. And that's really driving, a lot of the social science has found, it's really driving this kind of parenting, is that these parents are feeling this intense pressure for their children to stay in the same class they were born into or rise into a higher class, and it's the richest families who are able to throw the most money at doing so.
I'm wondering what this looks like in practice. I feel like we're talking about these big picture numbers here, Claire Kane Miller, but tell us from what you found in your piece in the New York Times, what are some things that a middle class family is able to do that a working class family might want to do, but is maybe unable to afford or unable to make work logistically because of the different challenges that come with being of a lower income level?
Sure. So some of them are things we've heard about before. These are things like, your kid is not just in school, but they're also in lessons. So they're learning piano and they're learning French in addition to whatever they're learning in school. But it's also, volunteering, trying to fill out their resume, doing traveling sports leagues instead of, just the municipal sports league that maybe a lower earning family cannot do the traveling sports leagues, but we know that those are the sports leagues in which the kids advance the most and which colleges seem to care a lot about. But there's also other things that really struck me when I became a parent and they were happening. I could see them around me. I didn't quite realize how tied they were to this, but it's things like video baby monitor so that you can sort of always, this pressure, you should always have one eye on your baby.
Right.
Or this pressure that you should home make your baby food, not buy it jarred, and you should have exclusive breastfeeding. Doesn't matter if you go back to work, no formula. Most people can't pull these things off, but there is this pressure to do them, and it all is tied back to this idea that your children need to be your top priority and that your priority needs to be to do everything you can so that they are the healthiest and the most successful and that they can achieve the most. And so when they're an infant, you're not thinking of their college resume, but really it is all tied together into how you can give them the best start in life.
Right. Professor Leroux, I'm curious quickly to get your thought. The thing that struck a lot of people who read this piece was not just that this difference exists, that these pressures exist for parents, but also that working class parents wanted the same kinds of expensive interventions, things that cost a lot of money, that recognized that they were things that they wanted for their kids. I'm wondering if you can talk about that pressure, whether that is new or whether that's something we've observed previously.
Well, I think that the jury is still out on that. I mean, a lot of these are surveys that show that working class parents want that. And I think it's difficult for parents to say, nah, I don't want to read to my kid, or I don't want to have organized activities, because these have iconic status in the culture. And so in the study I did, a lot of the working class parents, thought that those might be okay, but they also thought it was important for kids to relax and not to be too busy. And they also thought it was very important to be with family. And so some of these activities often conflict with family. They conflict with family dinners. They conflict with family graduation parties. And so some of the working class families I studied were skeptical of it. But we do see in the survey research working class parents reporting doing more time reading to children. And I'm not sure if they feel that they should be doing the reading or they're actually doing the reading. I think it's unclear.
Right. Stand by Professor Annette Leroux, Professor of Sociology at the University of Pennsylvania, Claire Kane Miller, correspondent of The New York Times, Matthias Depka, Professor of Economics at Northwestern University. We are discussing modern intensive parenting, and we're taking your calls, 866-893-KPCC. Tell me, as a parent, do you feel pressure to keep up with societal standards of parental excellence? Coming up, I'm going to overlay on this conversation another very important factor, and that is the issue of race and how that intersects with these expectations of parenting. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Back in a minute. We're talking about the relentlessness of modern parenting here on Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Kyle Stokes, and for Larry Mantle, discussing the societal expectations around parenting and how they intersect with very important factors like socioeconomics. Do middle-class parents and working-class parents experience the pressures of parenthood the same way? Obviously, the answer is no, they don't. Discussing exactly how it looks different. One other factor that we haven't discussed yet is race. And I'd like to go to Christian in Riverside, who's called in. Christian, you say you were raised in a biracial home.
Yes, absolutely. So my father is Hispanic and comes from a working class background. And my mother is white and comes from college educated master's degrees with both of her parents.
And how did it affect their styles of parenting?
Especially on my dad's side, I wouldn't say not just my dad, but his entire side of the family. There's a lot more pressure to represent and to kind of carry the torch into the next generation and to kind of continue and further that line, whereas my mom definitely didn't feel that kind of pressure to impart that to me because her family kind of already had the idea that they had arrived, so to speak.
Interesting. So was there ever a desire to, I mean, were you growing up around in more of a white community or in more of a Latino community? Where was your, what was your sort of context from where you were experiencing growing up?
Kind of straight down the middle. So I'm in Riverside. I definitely live in the white suburb. I've been educated in Catholic school my entire life. And that's mostly through my dad's side. So in the context of my family, it's definitely Hispanic and Latino, and that culture is there. And then when I was in school and on the occasion with my mom's family, I was kind of the token minority student.
Interesting. I'm so glad that you called in, Christian, to sort of give us a window in on this. Christian in Riverside, thank you. And with that, I'd like to bring in an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Maryland, Don Dow. Professor Dow is the author of the forthcoming book, Mothering While Black, The Boundaries of Middle Class Parenthood. Professor Dow, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I want to overlay the question of race onto this conversation. One of the things that I found very interesting in the piece in the New York Times that we're discussing today, The Relentlessness of Modern Parenting, was an anecdote from a middle-class black mother who said that her decisions revolve around protecting protecting her kids from early experiences of racism. And that was the hub of a lot of her decisions around parenting. Like raising a child in a mostly black neighborhood so that they would face less racism, even though it meant that they might be further away from many activities. Can you talk about how race overlays onto these expectations of parenthood?
Sure. Obviously, black middle class or black middle class mothers, parents are also engaged in a lot of these activities in terms of enrolling their children and extracurricular activities and trying to give them access to activities that would help them reproduce their middle-class status in the next generation. But they're often carefully considering factors like the diversity in those activities so their children don't feel racially isolated. And sometimes that's born from even their own experiences growing up, having been in similar kinds of activities where they felt racially isolated, so not wanting to reproduce those experiences for their children. And they're also often trying to instill some version of a black racial identity in their child in addition to helping them reproduce their economic status. So their priorities in choosing activities may contain different concerns that are related to protecting their children from later, from early experiences of racism, and that varies for their, the kinds of concerns they have vary for their sons versus their daughters. And so that makes them sensitized to certain factors, such as the diversity in the school population, as well as the teachers and administrators and making decisions. And because of that, they have often confront more limitations in their choices because there may not be a black middle-class neighborhood with a black middle-class with a school that, that has the same sort of resources as a white middle-class neighborhood. So when they decide to choose one of those versus the other, they then think about how they can balance out those activities with other kinds of exposures for their children so in, throughout their lives.
One of the points I understand you make is that we can talk about these pressures being new, about some of the trends that show economic spending, parents spending more on their children, that this is indicative of a new pressure that parents in the middle class are feeling about raising their children. But I understand one of the points that you make is that this is a kind of pressure that particularly black families have faced in a lot of ways for years and have been grappling with in their own ways.
Well, particularly in terms of having to make decisions around racial comfort for their children. So these are kinds of concerns that have been prevalent for black families for a long period of time, and particularly those who are middle class, who are sometimes making decisions about whether or not they want to live in a predominantly white neighborhood or a predominantly black neighborhood and what that will mean in terms of their children's interactions with their peers. And I would also say that in terms of intensive parenting, with the focus on nuclear families and the parents being responsible for making these decisions, within black middle-class families, at least those that I spoke to, there was really a desire to have more engagement from their community and family members in supporting mothers as they raise their kids. So the template, or at least the ideal template for raising children, while containing these extracurricular efforts, also contained other family members. So at times it's not as reliant on just the two parents that are there, but also a community of other family members, as well as just general community members who are participating in child rearing.
Professor Don Dow of the University of Maryland is joining us, discussing the idea of the relentless expectations of modern parenting and how they intersect with questions of race and class. How would a black middle-class mother face a different kind of pressure than a white working-class parent? That's part of the takeaway of the piece that we're discussing in the New York Times. I want to go to Canoga Park and Elva, who's calling in. Elva, thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You are an intensive parent.
So, yes, I have a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old, and one of the things that I try to do with my kids is, you know, just try to help them more, because as a child of immigrants, I encounter things that I don't want my own children to have to go through. So preparing them I know that they're young, but starting them young, I'm hoping to give them a head start.
What are the things that you do differently or things that you feel like are, you know, extras, that it's like, this is, I'm doing this because I want to be good. I want to give them an extra leg up.
Well, my kids are still tiny, but I do, just like sight words, days of the week, colors, all that stuff that I don't remember my parents doing with me. They're still small, but I'm also a high school teacher. My husband and I are. And so we know what it takes to get into college. And I'm just hoping to give them, you know, just a bit of a head start so that they can go into, you know, kindergarten with a little bit more advanced. And I know some of, you know, colleagues that tell me what they do with their kids. And I think, okay, I gotta start that, you know, just because I sort of see what everyone else is doing. I'm hoping that my kids will get a benefit from it as well.
Elva, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Tiffany in Lakewood, thank you so much for joining us as well.
Hi. So me and my husband are newlyweds. We're also new homeowners, and we're also newly considered middle class. And we're getting a lot of pressure from our parents to start having a family. And one of the reasons why we're putting it off is because not only the economic aspect, because while we're new into the middle class, we're also just realized that we would have money for the kid, maybe tutoring, maybe a ballet class and all that stuff that seems to be required to have kids these days, but we'd have no money for anything else. But beyond that, we see our friends with kids, and we both, me and him, talk about, I don't know if we have the energy to put in all that time, because we both work full time and, you know, we have pets, and it's just kind of like, I feel stretched as it is with our puppy. And what I've just seen that's different, because like the caller said before, like my, both of our parents are white, upper middle class. We were latchkey kids. Like we, I came home from school and was by myself for most of the time. I played with my siblings. So I was like, the way that my friends parent their kids, like they're with them 24/7. I'm like, don't they ever want to just be by themselves?
Yeah.
I don't know if you're allowed to let your kid be by themselves and just play alone. And I don't know if I have the energy to do that. So when our parents are like, where's our kids?
Yeah.
We're like, we're just not really that excited to do it, because it just seems like they do so much more activities now, the cost. And, you know, with us working, I don't know if I have the time.
Like, right. Right. I think this is a really important question. I'd like to put it to Matthias Depka, who's a professor of economics. Tiffany, thank you so much for joining us. Matthias, can you talk about this? I mean, is there any evidence that people are looking at the cost of parenting and saying, nah, not interested? And is that affecting any of the data that's coming downstream as well, this sort of parental attrition, so to speak?
So what Tiffany is saying very much rhymes with my own experience, because I also grew up in a world where parents fed children. We were expected to come home at night, but there was really very little else. You know, parents had their own time, kids had their own time to play, and there was a lot of freedom. And the way we raise our own kids now is very different, with very much involvement, many activities, and a very intensive parenting style. And what we point out is it's really the economic environment, that nowadays the gap between those who went to college and those who didn't has gone up enormously. And so parents really have a good reason to worry about their kids doing well in school. And so they respond to this in a very very rational way, one might say, by trying to put in a lot of more effort into this parenting. What we can see from other countries, yes?
Mm-hmm. No, go ahead. I'm sorry. Make your point.
Yes. So what we're looking a lot at the data across countries, and we see that in countries that have lower inequality, where there's a big gap between the returns to college and those who didn't go to college is much lower. In those countries, parenting is still very relaxed. For example, we have lower inequality, and there, you know, parents don't really have the same pressure to do all these activities, and they give a lot more freedom to their kids. Now, they don't really worry as much about homework and private schools, and it's a lot more like the parenting that we maybe experienced as children ourselves in a different generation, which suggests that really doing something about the economic inequality is also a possible route to make parenting easier for the current generation.
Yeah. Talking about the relentlessness of modern parenting, we're happy to take your calls at 866-893-KPCC. We're going to continue this conversation after a break. Just to read through a few of the comments that we've received on the AirTalk page. Geez, I'm glad. This is Pippi on the AirTalk page. Geez, I'm glad that I had a childhood, that didn't involve being force-fed lessons in every freaking situation. What happened to having fun, you know, going to the beach or park, playing baseball with the neighborhood kids? Keelan from Altadena, Keelan, said, I took emergency custody of my 9-year-old, and within 6 months of my intensive parenting, she went from a C student to an A student. And as far as race goes, teaching my child things about his race was crucial to his development. We're going to continue to take calls from parents right after a break here. It's 866-893-KPCC. That's the number to call. If you want to weigh in on the expectations that you face as a parent in the modern age, and if you're a middle-class parent, a working-class parent, how do you view the expectations around parenthood? Again, the phone number, 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-5722. We'll continue this conversation. Take your calls after a break. You're listening to Air Talk. We'll be right back after this news break from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. Back with you here on Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, continuing our discussion of intensive parenting, the expectations that have evolved around modern parenting, and how parents from different backgrounds, socially, economically, racially, culturally, experience those pressures. Alyssa in Long Beach, want to join us. Thank you so much for joining us. Excuse me.
Hi, this is Alyssa from Long Beach.
Yeah. So you say that you have young kids in school?
I do. I'm an African-American mother, and I have two children, 4 and 7, at a school where they are often the only African-American student in the classroom. And I chose this school because of, you know, the great resources and the scores, and it's an amazing school district. But my challenge is, you know, as an African-American mother, I also want to make sure that my students are exposed to diverse communities. And so for us, our church has played that role. It's primarily African-American. And a part of the issue that I face is making sure that my kids understand the importance of the African-American culture and what they bring to the table, even though they're at a school where they're the only one. So I don't want them to see African-American communities or their ethnicity as less than others.
The New York Times article we're discussing, Alyssa, quotes a middle-class black mother who said that she decided to live farther away from the quality schools that she was looking for, from the sports leagues that her kids were probably looking for, from parks, from grocery stores, because she was, I'm filling in some of the details there, excuse me, but, you know, that she felt like she wanted to make sure that have her kids grow up in a black neighborhood. And that was the first thing, to try and shield them from early experiences of racism. It sounds like you approached that challenge differently.
I did. Fortunately, we have other resources and other communities, again, such as our church, that have really helped to fill that void. But it is a daily struggle that I experience, and, you know, making sure that my kids understand the importance of cultural diversity when they may not see it every day.
Interesting. Alyssa, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Justine in Santa Paula, it sounds like you are a reformed intensive parent.
Yeah. I actually grew up in the Hollywood area in the 80s, and back then it was pretty – kids had a lot of freedom, and we just basically were out all day, and we came home at night, and it was normal. And then I got married pretty young, and I ended up moving to the west side of Los Angeles, kind of an upper middle class lifestyle in Santa Monica, Brentwood area. And I had I have kids ages 9 to 31, 5 kids. So the oldest ones were raised in the Santa Monica area, and I found it really hard because kids never played outside. And everybody was in so many lessons. There was so much pressure. There was constantly tutors. And kids just didn't have much. It didn't seem like you would drive through a neighborhood and you just wouldn't see any children, like in the Santa Monica area. And my son was the only one that rode a bicycle to school. And then I was shamed by a bunch of parents for letting him do that. And so I decided to move to a farm in Santa Paula, which is kind of extreme. But just the way kids are raised, like, out here versus in that part of LA is so different that it's pretty amazing. Like here, I think it has to do with the socioeconomic class, like you're mentioning, but
yeah, I'm curious.
You have more freedom here for sure. You see them on bicycles. They take the bus. They're in lessons, but you don't feel that kind of intense pressure. You felt like by the age of 2 years old, if you didn't have your kid in the right preschool, you know, on the right track, it was like a disaster.
Well, but does that pressure still exist? Were there ways in which you still did things that you might have thought of as extra at one point? Even after you sort of took your family to Santa Paula out of the sort of urban area where it felt like free range parenting was less acceptable.
Yeah. Well, we still do have to do, you know, we do music lessons and things like that, but there isn't the kind of, like, if you decide not to do it for a while, or you decide to sit out a couple of seasons of sports, it's not like this feeling of disaster that your kid's never going to catch up or, get in the right college. My kids all went to good colleges and they didn't really do all that stuff. We didn't have SAT tutoring. And I just think those parents put like a lot of pressure on themselves that doesn't really need to be there.
Right. Justine in Santa Paula, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Okay.
We've been discussing the piece called The Relentlessness of Modern Parenting by Claire Kane Miller, who is a correspondent for The New York Times. Claire, I just want to make one last point in the minute or so that we have left, and that's that a lot of the burden of parenting, as it falls on gender lines, dads have assumed a little bit more of the work, it sounds like, though, that mothers are continuing to bear the lion's share of the responsibilities here. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. Dads are doing more, and these survey results show that people think dads should do a lot of this intensive stuff. But when it comes down to time, it is really the mothers who are spending much, much more time on this. And when it comes down to the pressure, it's really the mothers who feel the most of the cultural pressure to do this and feel most guilty when they can't keep up.
I want to make that point before we let it go, because we're talking about so many different intersections of the expectations that parents face from society and how that affects parents of different cultural backgrounds, racial backgrounds, economic backgrounds. I wanted to make sure we got gender in there as well. Claire Kane Miller, correspondent for The New York Times, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
We're also joined today by Don Dow, assistant professor for sociology at the University of Maryland and the author of the forthcoming book, Mothering While Black. Annette Leroux, professor of sociology at the University of Pennsylvania, who helped coin the term intensive parenting. And also Matthias Depka, professor of economics at Northwestern University, co-author of the forthcoming book, Love, Money, and Parenting, How Economics Explains the Way We Raise Our Kids. Coming up, we're going to take a look at the far edges of our solar system. Stay with us. We're going on a billion-mile journey right after this. As we were marking the start of a new year here on Earth yesterday, at the same time, a team of scientists was marking a new milestone in space exploration. Billions of miles away from here, the New Horizons spacecraft flew by a small object in space called Ultima Thule. NASA tells us that it makes Ultima Thule the most distant object ever visited by a spacecraft. And it's an object in a part of space that could tell us a lot about the formation of our own solar system. With us to discuss this is Henry Throop, the science team member on the New Horizons mission, a senior scientist at the Planetary Science Institute headquartered in the Arizona, part of the team that's making this mission go. Henry, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me a call.
Absolutely. So let's just reset here for a second. What is the New Horizons spacecraft and what is its mission?
So this is a mission which has been out there flying for 12 years. It launched in 2006, and it's a real destination when we launched it was to go to Pluto. And we did a great flyby of Pluto in 2015, and we ended up with a healthy spacecraft, and we searched for a target outward beyond Pluto. And we found one. We found one in 2014, just before we got to Pluto. And when we go further out in the solar system, we're seeing stuff which is older, which is more primitive, and that's what we've flown past just this past weekend.
And why did you choose Ultima Thule as your target?
Ultima Thule, there are probably hundreds of thousands or millions of Kuiper Belt objects out there. Ultima Thule is the one that we found. We didn't have a destination in mind when we launched the spacecraft, so we had to actively go out there and search for one. And we searched for one which was along our path, and we had some fuel on board that we could redirect the spacecraft a very slight amount. And so we searched for something that would be on our path. We found three of them. Ultima Thule was the one that was closest to our path. And that's going to save fuel so that we can perhaps in the future go past even one or two more.
I love asking space people how close is close, because space terms, nothing close is ever close. How close are we talking about?
Well, we flew 3,500 kilometers above the surface of this one.
Wow.
The distance that it is, it's 4 billion miles away from us right now. So, yeah, it's a long way out there. It takes 12 hours for a radio signal moving at the speed of light to go from the Earth out to the spacecraft and back again. So it's far out there.
Where were you and how did you receive news of this flyby?
So there were two things we did at flyby. We had it at a little bit after midnight on New Year's Eve was the moment where the spacecraft actually was taking the bulk of its pictures flying past this ancient surface. But we didn't receive word of the spacecraft until about 10 hours after that, and that's because the spacecraft can only do one thing at a time, and it was busy taking pictures. We didn't want to have it take a break from its schedule just to tell us what was going on. So we had it dedicated to taking the images and the other data, and then a couple hours after that, it turned its radio signal back toward us and sent us what we call a phone home message to tell us how its passage through the Ultima Thule system was. And so we heard that about 10 o'clock in the morning. And, of course, that's the really exciting thing leading up to what we've been getting now, which is the first images coming down from the system.
You actually call it, by the way, a phone home message? That's like a technical term?
Well, you know, that's what we call this one, Yvette.
I was wondering, you're Spielberg fans, obviously. I appreciate it.
We've all been there, yes.
I understand that you're coming off the fresh release of some new images at this point.
That's right. So this is our one of our best images that we're going to get. We have two more sets of images that are going to be at higher resolution, which will be releasing later this week and then later this month. But already with these images, what we're seeing is this just very strange and very old surface. This doesn't look like anything like the planets, for instance. When the planets, you have a lot of geology. They've been hit a lot. They've been bashed up. They have craters. They have volcanoes, things like this. This is something which has been sitting in this ice box, in this cooler, in this deep freeze for billions of years. And in the outer solar system, things are colder, things move slower. And because of that, they're a lot more primordial. They're like they were when the solar system was formed 4.5 billion years ago. So this thing is this is showing the raw ingredients of the components that went into building up the solar system.
Well, hold that thought. Henry Throop, a science team member behind the New Horizons mission. I want to bring in Emily Lakdawalla, who's a senior editor at the Planetary Society, which is a nonprofit space education organization. Emily, thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
We're talking about this primordial area of space, primordial. You get a sense of soup. It's in a region of space called the Kuiper Belt. I'm wondering if you can tell me exactly what that is.
Well, it's a part of space that's beyond Neptune. In fact, Neptune shaped it early in the formation of the solar system. And the cool thing about it for this mission is that it's a part of space that hasn't experienced a lot since our solar system formed 4.5 billion years ago. So we're really studying the ingredients that our solar system was made of. This little tiny world is just one unremarkable world, only remarkable because it just happens to be the one that we explored. But there's tens of thousands more like it, and many more millions of them formed the giant planets when the solar system was first coming into being. So by studying this one little world, we're getting snapshots of what things were like before any of us were here.
Take us a layer deeper on some of these questions. You often hear about deep space objects holding sort of clues to the formation of our solar system. What are those big open questions that this might provide some data to help us answer?
But we like to say that the two fundamental questions that motivate most of space research and exploration are, how did we get here, and are we alone? And this particular piece of exploration doesn't answer the are we alone question, but it really goes at the how did we get here? How did a bunch of dust just floating in interstellar space lead eventually to humans actually contemplating their own beings on one planet in close to the center of this solar system? And so this is about the ingredients of the solar system. It's about how we all came to be. The cool, I think, the greatest thing about what we've seen in the new images that came down is that it's a contact binary. It's an object that looks like we actually kind of predicted it would look like. The physicists have been getting some predictions right, and that gives us confidence that some of the other things that they're saying about the formation of the solar system are also correct. Being right doesn't happen a whole lot in space exploration, so it's really wonderful when it happens.
What are some of the other things that they've been saying about the formation of the solar system that you think that this helps vindicate?
Well, I think it helps talk about like what the sizes of the little worlds were and what their dynamics were, what their shapes were, how common it is to have things that formed in these binary systems. And then because they're the ingredients that you use to make the giant planets, then the greater physics about assembling all of those into giant planets, the process of making the planets, how fast it all happened, and what happened after they first formed. Those are all the kinds of stories we're trying to understand right now.
Emily Lakdawalla, thank you so much. Henry Throop, on the New Horizons team, I'm curious if you can sort of talk to me a little bit about what these images show. I haven't seen the newer images. The older images looked just sort of like pixels. They were maybe, I mean, you know, you could count the number of pixels in the image that were being sent back that seemed to depict the Ultima Thule object. Are these new images any larger than that?
Yeah, so those first images, those were taken in the hours before we were at the target. And these latest images are taken much, much closer. Still not the highest resolution, but we're seeing hundreds and hundreds of pixels across in about 100 pixels by 100 pixels in these images. And so what you see is it actually looks like a snowman. And you can see what may be craters or at least depressions and bulges and things like that on the surface. You can see these things are connected just like the neck on a snowman, has a region where those areas are connected. And so what these are basically, you can think of them as really kind of low-speed bowling balls maybe in space. And so they've sort of have tumbled over each other, and they've kind of docked with each other.
Meaning, so like two – just since people can't see it, this is like – it's a snowman because two pieces of rock have come together. There was even discussion at one point, I understand, of whether they were two closely orbiting objects.
That's right. And originally, this probably was multiple orbiting objects. You probably had two or three or four there. And what we now have is these two who have closed in on each other, and kind of like you would be building a snowman by gently stacking one, the head on top of the body. That's how this process happened in space, by at very low speed these bodies coming together and sticking, and they've sort of slowly evolved since then. But it's largely telling us what the processes were that built up from dust particles to pebbles to boulders and to larger bodies like this. Each of these balls is about 5 or 10 kilometers across or so, and then these ultimately go into forming the planets in our solar system.
You said 5 to 10 kilometers across. Is that how big Ultima Thule is?
Yeah. We have two of these bodies, maybe each 10 kilometers across, that goes into into Ultima Thule.
Is there anything about Ultima Thule that was remarkable before this mission, or is it remarkable? Is it remarkable because this is the one that the spacecraft flew by? In other words, is this different from other Kuiper Belt objects? Is it remarkable or stand out in any way from other Kuiper Belt objects?
The thing that's remarkable about this is that 2 days before we got there, we knew nothing about it. We didn't know the basic parameters of the system. There is nothing in the solar system that we've ever flown by before.
Wow.
That we've known less about than this target, because it's so small, so dark, it's so far away, that with the best telescopes on Earth, including the Hubble Space Telescope, and including our own spacecraft as it was hurtling through space toward this target, we couldn't even tell the basic parameters of the system. And so, given our knowledge, we were executed a terrific flyby and under really difficult conditions, and are really swimming in this wonderful data set here.
Right, which is so cool, because you talk about those pixelated images and the prediction of what this looked like, that it comes true. You see the progression from these pixelated images to what is actually coming back, these high-resolution images. It's really remarkable work and vindicating of this physicist's work. Thank you so much to both of you for joining us. Henry Throop, a science team member on the New Horizons mission. Really appreciate your time, Henry. Thanks.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And as well as Emily Lakdawalla, a senior editor at the Planetary Society, a nonprofit space education organization. Emily, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And thank you, all of you, for joining us here on Air Talk on KPCC. A reminder, tomorrow we're coming back to pick up our discussion of the LAUSD potential teachers' strike with a conversation with the teachers' union's president, Alex Caputo-Pearl. We'll see you tomorrow here on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Kyle Stokes, in for Larry Mantle.